and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman has the evening off. Here's what we're looking at.
I want to say this clearly. There were other options.
Mayor Johnson says the city budget is coming up short on revenue. We get reaction from Alder people.
An election system so broken and so vulnerable that no one can possibly defend it.
And President Trump doubles down on his claims of mass amounts of election fraud. What to know about the country's voting security? First off tonight, the tally of cyclosporiasis cases in Illinois climbs as public health officials struggle to determine the source of the infection. The state says there are now 355 confirmed and probable cases of the illness, which causes severe diarrhea. According to the city's public health department, Chicago's seen 76 confirmed and probable cases as of today, with a dozen more under investigation. The Food and Drug Administration announced yesterday that a lab result that found cyclospora in lettuce supplied by the company Taylor Farms from Mexico was a false positive. Still, the agency says it has very strong evidence that Taylor Farms shredded lettuce is behind the outbreak. The company said late last week it would voluntarily remove all iceberg lettuce sourced from central Mexico. Eviction protections are emerging as a sticking point in the City Hall debate over rental housing. Last month, Mayor Brandon Johnson introduced the Protecting Renters Ordinance, or PRO. Then last week, a group of Alder people responded with the Fair and Accountable Illinois Rental Ordinance, or FAIR. While the two plans share similarities, the mayor's plan would create just cause eviction protections, requiring landlords to provide a valid reason for evictions or lease non-renewals. Today, advocates speaking in support of PRO say the opposing plan would be a step backwards for tenants.
Chicago landlords filed 20,000 evictions last year. Isn't that the housing crisis we're trying to solve? Where are these so-called housing providers for the people in crisis?
And you can join us tomorrow night for an in-depth discussion with supporters of both ordinances. Cook County is touting $15 million in funding for storm relief. County commissioners last week approved the one-time funding package for households dealing with fallout from flooding and other damage caused by major storms in July and August of last year, storms for which the federal government denied aid. Half of the money is designated for city residents and half for suburban Cook County residents, with up to $2,000 in funding available per household. Meanwhile, the Chicago area remains under an air quality alert, with potentially severe thunderstorms expected tonight and into the early morning. The Illinois Environmental Protection Agency has issued an air pollution action day expiring at midnight, with the air quality still unhealthy for sensitive groups. The National Weather Service is tracking a storm system traveling into southeast Illinois beginning around 7 p.m., with damaging winds reported as the greatest possible threat, but with the welcome benefit of clearing the air of particulates. Tomorrow and Wednesday's air quality is expected to be moderate. Up next, what to know about the country's voting security.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
President Donald Trump renews his claims about threats to election security and integrity as the midterm elections approach. In a speech last week, Trump discussed foreign interference, non-citizen voting, vulnerabilities in the American election system, and reiterated some widely disproven charges. His administration recently released a trove of heavily redacted documents, which Trump says prove his allegations of voter fraud. Joining us to discuss the issue are Jacob Braun, executive director of the Cyber Policy Initiative at the University of Chicago and former acting principal cyber director under the Biden administration, and Stephen Maynard Caliendo, professor of political science and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at North Central College in Naperville. Thank you both for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this issue of non-citizens voting. The Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen, he sent letters to the secretaries of state in Pennsylvania, Nevada, New Jersey, and California. He claims that, quote, through preliminary reviews of the four states' records, DHS found there may be as many as 278,000 non-citizens illegally on their state voter rolls. Stephen, what's your reaction to that claim?
I mean, there's no foundation for it. I mean, it seems like that these were brought about by some publicly available materials. Up to 250,000 voters could be one voter. It's a federal crime to register to vote and or to try to cast a vote if you're not a U.S. citizen, if you're not eligible to vote. It's very rare. It doesn't happen very often. The fact that President Trump took to a primetime address to do this is problematic, but it's also consistent with what he's done really for 10 years in terms of sowing doubt about the security of our election system.
Yeah, I mean, that leads me right to my next question. You know, despite all these, you know, these years of claims, there, you know, is there evidence of widespread non-citizen voting?
No, there's certainly not, and there wasn't prior. You know, scholarly work has shown that it's very rare. And then when the president was in his first term, he had a task force to look into this. They spent a lot of money and never even issued a final report because he dissolved it before they had a chance to do so because they didn't find anything. Mm.
The president also warned of foreign interference in American elections. Here's some of what he had to say.
Over a period of years, starting during the 2020 election cycle, the People's Republic of China carried out what is believed to be the largest compromise of election data in history, resulting in China's illicit acquisition of 220 million U.S. voter files.
Jake, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think there's a couple different things going on here. One is traditional espionage. The Chinese have conducted espionage on U.S. elections for decades, as many other countries have. That's not good. We try and prevent it in any way we can. But also, it generally doesn't seek to change the outcome of an election. Secondly, by most intel estimates to date, the Chinese really don't favor one political party over the other. They generally think that both parties are kind of against them. And they view that getting caught trying to change an election would have a worse downside for them than any upside of actually getting one party or the other into the White House or Congress.
So, you know, if China and other countries aren't trying to influence the outcome, why are they trying to obtain election information?
Well, I think they try and obtain the election information for intelligence purposes, to find out information on U.S. citizens they're interested in, elected officials, intelligence officers, et cetera, et cetera. But what the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, multiple actors are doing is trying to undermine our faith in our electoral process and our institutions that really underpin the citizens' franchise with the government.
Yeah. You know, Stephen, in 2016, you know, you heard a lot from Democrats discussing Russian interference. You know, today, certainly the president and some other Republicans claiming elections are vulnerable. Did the politics around this issue, did they flip in some way?
I don't know that they flipped so much. I mean, what the Democrats were arguing about 2016 was that the Russians were involved in infiltrating social media to, as Jake mentioned, cause disruption, to cause us to have sort of a failing belief in our system. The Democrats claimed that they were trying to help Donald Trump win because they thought it would be favorable to them. There's not necessarily evidence of that. But I think what was dangerous about Thursday night was the conflation of foreign involvement in elections like that, foreign interference, which is, as Jake was sort of suggesting, you know, they're not taking our ballots and changing them. And so the outcomes aren't changing. And so I think just throwing all this together as one big, you know, kind of soup and then suggesting that the elections aren't safe, I think we have to be careful about what the implications are for that sort of messaging from the White House.
Yeah. You know, Jake, when you look at our voting infrastructure, what are the vulnerabilities there?
They're significant, actually, and several of the reports that were released after the president's speech highlight vulnerabilities that, by the way, we've known about for nearly a decade, but nonetheless still need to be fixed. And I do think both parties are at fault in the sense that Democrats often jump in and say, just because Trump said it, it's wrong. And then the administration wants to double down on election interference claims that have been debunked. But it seems like nobody's really getting after solving the actual problem, which is better security around our elections, and that's both of the machines and the government systems, like the voter registration databases and so on, that the elections rely on.
Yeah, I know this is something you've worked on quite a bit. What are some of the key remedies there?
Well, there's a few pretty simple ones, and all of them, by the way, are the cheapest options. Number one is hand-marked paper ballots, because at the very least, if everything goes wrong, a bunch of humans can go back and hand-count every single ballot. So that's number one. Number two, a little bit more technical, but still less expensive, is open-source voting equipment. So this would be where anybody can see the code that's in the voting machine or the voting equipment. Right now, the only people who see the code are the bad guys and the vendors, and we want everybody, including the good guys, to be able to see if there's problems that need to be solved.
Yeah, a measure of transparency.
Exactly. Yeah. And that way, when somebody says that there's a backdoor with Venezuela into the voting equipment, then everybody can see the code and say, is there one or not, and be able to have transparency on that. And then finally, we really need to get rid of touchscreen voting machines because they cause incredibly long lines, which dramatically affects minority populations, student populations, groups that have a higher density in their precincts, which are largely urban and student areas.
Yeah, potential suppression of votes.
Exactly.
Can I say, I think Jake had a really nice point there about the messenger, in a sense, is that if it was somebody else making these claims or somebody else asking these questions, we would receive it differently. The issue is that the president started talking about election interference because he didn't understand how he might have lost an election in 2020. Well, he talked about the Russian hoax first and then 2020. And now he's talking about it because he's worried about future elections. And I think that undermines the real questions that are there and the real opportunities we have to do things better. So the messenger in this case does matter.
Yeah. Well, you know, Trump also used this speech. You know, he's advocating for this Save America Act. This legislation would require proof of citizenship, mandate photo ID at the polls, impose criminal penalties to election officials if they, you know, register people who don't present the necessary documents. What sort of concerns do you have with
I have
that,
so many concerns about this one, partly because they're barriers to people being able to register to vote who should be able to. And I think we're trying to solve a problem that doesn't really exist. This isn't the vulnerabilities in the system problem. This is the argument that non-citizens have been voting in ways that are disrupting elections problem, which isn't a problem. So it's barriers to participation. But also, that last point you made about the election officials could be held criminally. We have a hard time getting election officials as it is.
Right.
We have a hard time getting people to do this work as it is. And the last thing that they're going to want to do is put themselves in a position where if there's a mistake made or something happens, they're going to be personally responsible. I mean, we don't have enough time to talk about all the problems with the SAVE Act, but those are two.
Jake, we've got just about 45 seconds left, but, you know, what is the barrier there? Why is the message not breaking through in a bipartisan manner that there is work to be done to make, you know, to make these changes that you've suggested for our election system?
Sure. You know, of course it's politics, and once politics gets in the middle of things, we generally tend to start fighting about politics and not about the problem. And I think that if both parties were to really kind of focus on actually getting after this the way that they could, because cyber is often quite nonpartisan, we could solve the problem relatively quickly. The solutions are not hard, and as I said a minute ago, they're the cheapest solutions out there.
That does have an added benefit there of getting folks on board. All right, that's where we'll have to leave it. Jake Braun, Stephen Maynard Caliendo, thank you very much. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Up next, officials say the city is facing a budget shortfall. Why that could be and what can be done about it, right after this. Brandon Johnson says Chicago is staring down a mid-year budget deficit, and he's pointing the finger at City Council. City officials said last week the city is grappling with an $89 million shortfall, revised down from the $130 million figure the mayor announced earlier this month. Last year, Alder people rejected Johnson's proposed head tax on the city's largest companies and instead approved a budget that relied on alternative revenue sources, including selling city debt to private collectors and licensing advertising on city light poles. So far, Johnson says much of that expected revenue hasn't materialized.
corporate-aligned members of the city council chose a different direction and adopted their so-called alternative budget. And throughout that process, we raised concerns about the assumptions in that plan, not to oppose for the sake of opposing, but because Chicagoans deserve honesty about the risks of budgets that rely on fines and fees.
But some older people are pushing back on the mayor's narrative and say he's slow rolling the implementation of the new revenues. Joining us with their thoughts on the city budget are Alderman William Hall, whose 6th ward on the city's south side includes parts of Englewood, Chatham, and Auburn Gresham, and Alderman Scott Wagispack, whose 32nd ward on the city's north side includes parts of Wicker Park, Lincoln Park, and Lakeview. Thank you both for being here. We
Thank
appreciate
you so much
it.
For having us.
So, Alderman Wagispack, you were part of the group of aldermen who passed the budget over Mayor Johnson's objections, and you've disputed the mayor's estimate of what's now an $89 million budget deficit. What do you think the true figure is?
I think it's about $100 million short, but it's $100 million short because the mayor didn't implement the budget that was passed. And as you recall, he didn't veto that budget. He basically said he was going to move forward with it. And what we've seen is just a failure to execute on what the legislature decided to pass. And that's where we are at this point. It's just a failure of execution by the Johnson administration.
So why would he, you know, if you see it this way, sort of inflate the deficit here?
Well, I think if you aren't taking care of the pieces of the budget that you are supposed to, you know, we put a handful of things in there that would help close that budget gap. If you're not executing those through the budget office, then you're not doing your part to make sure that when the legislator says, like they do in every city, here's what we would like to see in the budget, you have to move forward on those things, and they just failed to execute.
Alderman Hall, how about that idea that they're somehow slow walking implementation?
Well, I think number one, let's look at VGT. That was something proposed in the budget.
Video gambling.
It would take 3,300 slot machines in inner cities across the city of Chicago to generate the projected revenue. Well, all due respect, I don't think that gambling, number one, they assume that people will buy debt in the market, which means that those who have the burden of paying parking tickets, reason why it wasn't sold, by the way, is because people don't have it. So debt collection, gambling, and then liquor tax. So the best that we got in the 6th ward in this budget would be liquor, gambling, and 1-800 calls to give money. I think the Chicagoans deserve better. They deserve dignity. And a budget that doesn't preserve dignity is what we're dealing with right now. Over 3,000 people, both in the public schools as well as in city government, are going to lose their jobs. And so again, we're better than gambling. We're better than debt collections, and we're definitely better than what has been proposed. And so we knew, again, only having 48 hours to look at how do you spend $17 billion, it was irresponsible in the first place. Again, to obstruct is one thing, but not to have adequate solutions over the entire process. January 1st was the beginning of budget season, not necessarily December, 2 days before a threatened shutdown.
And I want to come back to some of those specific revenue items, but, you know, as we're heading into, you know, the fall coming up, you know, faster than we probably will be ready for and heading into another budget season, how difficult is it to negotiate and implement a spending plan when, as your colleague Alderman Haddon put it, you know, there's a deficit of trust?
Well, let me tell you, number one, the budget wasn't funded. So number two, essentially at the end of the day, what is there to negotiate at this point? Again, let's look at one of their streamlines of revenue, which was video gaming. They said that that would generate X, Y, and Z amount of million. 3,300. That's 3,300 slot machines had to be online. That was not realistic. Secondly, debt collection was a big deal. They thought that $90 million would be available by simply calling people with 1-800 numbers on their cell phone. Nobody wanted to touch our debt because the people in Chicago just don't have it. So those two budget lines of revenue was what they thought would be sufficient enough to balance the budget. And then augmented reality. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen a dime of that because essentially, again, it was unrealistic. So the ideas on paper, it was almost like a check that was written with no money in the bank. Now everybody's crying about the fact that the check is bouncing.
Yeah, I mean, Alderman Wagispack, how about that idea of, you know, selling the unpaid debt, you know, advertising on city light poles? You know, the administration says, we've been working on this, but we can't find, you know, buyers for the debt or advertisers interested in city property. What's your response to that?
I don't think they tried hard enough. It's very evident that when other cities are doing this, you're capable of doing it in Chicago. And I'm talking not just in Illinois, but around the United States. United States. When you look at the debt collection, I know the mayor's out there saying it's immoral to collect somebody's debt from somebody who parked at a fire hydrant or a developer who's not paying their fines or fees, but those are things that we've been collecting for decades. Other cities do it too. And the mayor has basically allowed $1 billion in additional debt to be created here over the last 3 years that he's just not collecting. And he's decided, I'm not going to do that because it's immoral. But if we can't move forward and say that people have to pay what they for something that they did, and I'm not talking about collecting from people who have to have water in their homes. Nobody has ever said that in their budget coalition. That is the mayor going out and misdirecting this entire budget. We're talking about also collecting from city employees and our sister agencies who owe tens of millions of dollars that the mayor refuses to collect on. Those are people at CPS, at the parks, at CHA. Everybody needs to make sure that if things are going to be fair and equitable, that they're paying for the wrongs that they did.
Well, essentially, at the end of the day, let's be honest. Let's look at the conditions that every Chicagoan and American is facing as well. We're down 11% on disposable income, meaning that 11% of what people had to spend, they don't have it anymore. The cost of food is rising. The cost of gas is almost at an all-time high. Affordability is the number one issue that people are facing across the city of Chicago. How dare we say to people who are down 11% and then to the 3,000 that are getting ready to lose their job, pay because you've made a mistake. How many of us have not paid a parking meter? I'm not justifying, again, irresponsibility, but what I am saying is that where is the compassion? We've seen grace periods extended. We've seen mercy programs. But at the end of the day, the reason why the debt did not sell is because people knew in the debt market that Chicagoans are broke. People are hurting. The average income in my ward is only $38,000 a year. Only one neighborhood is sovereign, and that one cannot carry the six. So if Chicagoans don't have the money, the best that 31 decided to offer to Chicagoans was more pressure to get money that they don't have, rather than saying, give us the money.
Well, I think that's just a complete falsehood. Nick, I've got to call that out, because we've heard this narrative from the mayor over and over and over again.
So what debt was being sold?
And when you look at the details of the debt.
He's not going to say what debt is going to be sold, and they went to the market with it, and nobody wanted to touch it, because,
we don't have the money.
Go ahead, Scott.
Again, it was for parking tickets. And you're telling me that people shouldn't pay their parking
tickets? No, what I'm saying is that
the
people don't have
the money. The mayor didn't even pay his water bills before he became mayor.
Scott, let's not live in a budget.
He wasn't hurting.
Let's not live in a bubble. People don't
have
it.
No one's living in a bubble here.
Again, just because the mayor didn't pay his water bill, that's his business. But at the end of the day, when I'm looking at, I represent a ward of 47,000 people making on average less than $40,000 a year.
Right, and there's 49 other wards.
So to penalize people who don't have it because they made a mistake, that is an irresponsible way to generate revenue.
And no one's penalizing anybody for that. Right. We are looking at large tranches of funding that could be had in this budget. When you look at the business community, the mayor has said, we're going to go ahead and put more burden on the business community. When you look at the PPLT, that's up by hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think what we're looking at here is the mayor decided he wasn't going to veto this budget because it was actually a good budget. We only looked at 2% of the entire budget. And he thought that 98% of it was good.
And I do want to ask, you know, what we heard from Mayor Johnson, you know, in that clip setting up the conversation is that, you know, he said that you and some of his other, critics and city council are aligned with corporations rather than the people of the city. What's your reaction to that?
That's just not the case. I mean, if you look at what he is billing for the small businesses, medium and large in the city, it's hundreds of millions more than when he came in. He's not even going after the people that we've said when we go for debt sale or we go for collections. We were saying they should go after everybody, developers included. And he had a day right before the budget where there was $8 million in uncollected fees from a developer. He allowed them to go ahead and pass an ordinance or basically go ahead with not paying that debt. So he's not even really taking the effort to get that done.
Okay, so again, we talk about just one line. And again, I don't think that 1-800 numbers calling residents of Chicago is the best means to raise revenue. Secondly, what was
but
not addressed...
nobody's doing that, Will.
When you sell the debt, they have a right to collect the debt. And their means of collecting debt is typically invasive, ignorant, and rude. Number two, which they have not mentioned, was the fact that VGTs was a part of their proposal. They would have had to put 3,300 machines online. That's virtually impossible.
Let me correct you, though, first, because the city does collect debt every day of the week. But we have different agencies
doing
it.
The second thing that he has yet to mention is the fact that VGTs was a part of their plan.
Well, okay. And it is. We've got about 15 seconds left.
I'll say VGT is. I admit that. It's $6 million out of the entire budget.
So at the end of the day.
What we haven't done is tax and rein in the sweepstakes machines by the thousands that the mayor said.
We could talk about this until midnight.
What we do know is that 2,000 people come August 31st will be losing their jobs.
All right.
Take that narrative to them.
All right.
But thank you.
We could keep going, but yes, unfortunately, we are out of time. Alderman William Hall, Alderman Scott Waggy's back. Thank you both. We appreciate it. And that's our show for this Monday night. If you're looking for more context on the complicated issues that matter most to you, sign up for our email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan. You can do that at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. The battle over renters' protections as two competing proposals work their way through City Hall. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.